Carlos Castaneda's The Second Ring of Power, Chapter 4, Part 1, The Janeiros. I woke up around 8 the next morning and found that LaGuardia had sunned my clothes and made breakfast. We ate in the kitchen in the dining area. When we had finished, I asked her about Lydia, Rosa, and Josefina. They seemed to have vanished from the house. They're helping Sol Dad, she said. She's getting ready to leave. Where's she going? Somewhere away from here. She has no more reason to stay. She was waiting for you, and you have already come. Are the little sisters going with her? No, they don't want to be here today. It looks as if today is not a good day for them to stick around. Why isn't it a good day? The Janeiros are coming to see you today, and the girls don't get along with them. If all of them are here together, they'll get into a most dreadful fight. The last time that happened, they nearly killed one another. Do they fight physically? You bet they do. All of them are very strong, and none of them wants to take second place. The Nawal told me that that would happen, but I am powerless to stop them. And not only that, but I have to take sides, so it's a mess. How do you know the Janeiros are coming today? I haven't talked to them. I just know that they will be here today. That's all. Do you know that because you see LaGuardia? That's right. I see them coming. And one of them is coming directly to you because you are pulling him. I assured her that I was not pulling anyone in particular. I said I had not revealed to anyone the purpose of my trip and that it had to do with something I had to ask Pablito and Nestor. She smiled coyly and said that fate had paired me with Pablito, that we were very alike, that undoubtedly he was going to see me first. She added that everything that happened to a warrior could be interpreted as an omen. Thus, my encounter with Soldad was an omen of what I was going to find out on my visit. I asked her to explain her point. The men will give you very little this time, she said. It's the women who will rip you to shreds, as Soldad did. That's what I would say if I read the omen. You're waiting for the Janeiros, but they are men like you. And look at this, and look at this other omen. They are a little bit behind. I would say a couple of days behind. That's your fate as well as theirs, as men. They will always be a couple days behind. Behind what, LaGuardia? Behind everything. Behind us women, for instance. She laughed and patted my head. No matter how stubborn you are, she went on, you have to admit that I am right. Wait and see. Did the Nawal tell you that men are behind women, I asked? Sure he did. All you have to do is look around. I do, LaGuardia, but I don't see any such thing. Women are always behind. They are dependent on men. She laughed. Her laughter was not scornful or bitter. It was rather a clear sound of joyfulness. You know the world of people better than I do, she said forcibly. But right now, I am formless, and you're not. I'm telling you, women are better sorcerers, because there is a crack in front of our eyes. There is none in front of yours. She did not seem angry, but I felt obliged to explain that I asked the questions and made comments, not because I was attacking or defending any given point, but because I wanted her to talk. She said that she had done nothing else but talk since the moment we met, and that the Nawal had trained her to talk because her task was the same as mine, to be in the world of people. Everything we say, she went on, is a reflection of the world of people. You will find out before your visit is over that you talk and act the way you do because you're clinging to the human form, just as the Janeiros and the Little Sisters are clinging to the human form when they fight to kill one another. But aren't all of you supposed to cooperate with Pablito, Nestor, and Benigno? Janeiro and the Nawal told every one of us that we should live in harmony and help and protect one another because we are alone in the world. Pablito was left in charge of us four, but he's a coward. If it were left up to him, he would let us die like dogs. When the Nawal was around, though, Pablito was very nice to us and took very good care of us. Everyone used to tease him and joke that he took care of us as if we were his wives. The Nawal engineer told him, not too long before they left, that he had a real chance to become the Nawal someday, because we might become his four winds and his four corners. Pablito understood it to be his task, and from that day on, he changed. He became insufferable. He began to order us around as if we were really his wives. I asked him now all about Pablito's chances, and he told me that I should know that everything in a warrior's world depends on personal power, and personal power depends on impeccability. If Pablito were impeccable, he would have a chance. I laughed when he told me that. I know Pablito very well, but the Nawal explained to me that I shouldn't take it so lightly. He said that warriors always have a chance, no matter how slim. He made me see that I was a warrior myself, and that I shouldn't hinder Pablito with my thoughts. He said that I should turn them off and let Pablito be, that the impeccable thing for me to do was to help Pablito in spite of what I knew about him. I understood what the Nawal said. Besides, I had my own doubt. I had my own debt with Pablito, and I welcomed the opportunity to help him. But I also knew that no matter how I helped him, he was going to fail. I knew all along that he didn't have what it takes to be like the Nawal. Pablito is very childish, and he won't accept his defeat. He's miserable because he's not impeccable, and yet he's still trying in his thoughts to be like the Nawal. How did he fail? As soon as the Nawal left, Pablito had a deadly run-in with Lydia. Years ago, the Nawal had given him the task of being Lydia's husband, just for appearances. The people around here thought she was his wife. Lydia didn't like that one bit. She's very tough. The truth of the matter is that Pablito has always been scared to death of her. They could never get along together, and they tolerated each other only because the Nawal was around. But when he left, Pablito got crazier than he already was and became convinced that he had enough personal power to take us as his wives. The three generals got together and discussed what Pablito should do and decided that he should take the toughest woman first, Lydia. They waited until she was alone, then all three of them came into the house and grabbed her by the arms and threw her on the bed. Pablito got on top of her. She thought at first that the generals were joking, but when she realized that they were serious, she hit Pablito with her head in the middle of the forehead and nearly killed him. The generals fled, and Nestor had to tend to Pablito's wound for months. Is there something I can do to help them understand? No, unfortunately, understanding is not their problem. All six of them understand very well. The real problem is something else, something very ugly that no one can help them with. They indulge in not trying to change. Since they know they won't succeed in changing, no matter how much they try, or want, or need to, they have given up trying altogether. That's as wrong as feeling disappointed about our failures. The Nawal told each of them that warriors, both men and women, must be impeccable in their effort to change, in order to scare the human form and shake it away. After years of impeccability, a moment will come, the Nawal said, when the form cannot stand it any longer, and it leaves, just as it left me. In doing so, of course, it injures the body and can even make it die. But an impeccable warrior survives, always. A sudden knock at the front door interrupted her. Lagorda stood up and went over to unlatch the door. It was Lydia. She greeted me very formally and asked Lagorda to go with her. They left together. I welcomed being alone. I worked on my notes for hours. The open-air dining area was cool and had very good light. Lagorda returned around noon. She asked me if I wanted to eat. I was not hungry, but she insisted that I eat. She said that the contacts with the Allies were very debilitating, and that she was very weak herself. After eating, I sat down with Lagorda and was getting ready to ask her about dreaming, when the front door opened loudly and Pablito walked in. He was panting. He obviously had been running and appeared to be in a state of great excitation. He stood at the door for a moment, catching his breath. He hadn't changed much. He seemed a bit older or heavier, or perhaps only more muscular. He was, however, still very lean and wiry. His complexion was pale, as if he had not been in the sun for a long time. The brownness of his eyes was accentuated by a faint mark of weariness in his face. I remember Pablito was having a beguiling smile as he stood there looking at me. His smile was as charming as ever. He ran over to where I was sitting and grasped my forearms for a moment without saying a word. I stood up. He then shook me gently and embraced me. I myself was utterly delighted to see him. I was jumping up and down with infantile joy. I did not know what to say to him. He finally broke the silence. "Maestro," he said softly, nodding his head slightly, as if he were bowing to me. The title of maestro, teacher, caught me by surprise. I turned around as if I were looking for someone else who was just behind me. I deliberately exaggerated my movements to let him know that I was mystified. He smiled, and the only thing that occurred to me was to ask him how he knew I was here. He said that he, Nesta, and Benigno had been forced to return because of a most unusual apprehension, which made them run day and night without any pause. Nesta had gone to their own house to find out if there was something there that would account for the feeling that had driven them. Benigno had gone to Soldad's house, and he himself had come to the girl's house. "You hit the jackpot," Pablito Lagorda said and laughed. Pablito did not answer. He glared at her. "I bet that you're working yourself up to throw me out," he said in a tone of great anger. "Don't fight with me," Pablito Lagorda said, unruffled. Pablito turned to me and apologized, then added in a very loud voice, as if he wanted someone else in the house to hear him, that he had brought his own chair to sit on, and that he would put it wherever he pleased. "There's no one else around here except us," Lagorda said softly and chuckled. "I'll bring in my chair anyways," Pablito said. "You don't mind, Maestro, do you?" I looked at Lagorda. She gave me an almost imperceptible go-ahead sign with the tip of her foot. "Bring it in. Bring in anything you want," I said. Pablito stepped out of the house. "They're all that way," Lagorda said. "All three of them." Pablito came back a moment later, carrying an unusual-looking chair on his shoulders. The chair was shaped to follow the contour of his back, so when he had it on his shoulders, upside down, it looked like a backpack. "May I put it down?" he asked. "Of course," I replied, moving the bench over to make room. He laughed with exaggerated ease. "Aren't you the Nawal?" he asked me, and then looked at Lagorda and added, "Or do you have to wait for orders?" "I am the Nawal," I said facetiously, in order to humor him. I sensed that he was about to pick a fight with Lagorda. She must have sensed it too, for she excused herself and went out back. Pablito put his chair down and slowly circled around me as if he were inspecting my body. Then he took his low-backed, narrow chair in one hand, turned it around, and sat down, resting his folded arms on the back of the chair that was made to allow him with maximum comfort as he sat astride it. I sat down facing him. His mood had changed completely the instant Lagorda left. "I must ask you to forgive me for acting the way I did," he said, smiling. "But I had to get rid of that witch." "Is she that bad, Pablito?" "You can bet on that," he replied. To change the subject, I told him that he looked very fine and prosperous. "You look very fine yourself, Maestro," he said. "What's this nonsense of calling me Maestro?" I asked in a joking tone. Things are not the same as before," he replied. "We are in a new realm, and the witness says that you are a Maestro now, and the witness cannot be wrong. But he will tell you the whole story himself. He'll be here shortly, and will he be glad to see you again. I think that by now he must have felt that you are here. As we were coming back, all of us had the feeling that you might be on your way, but none of us felt that you had already arrived." I told him then but I had come for the sole purpose of seeing him and Nesta, and that they were the only two people in the world with whom I could talk about our last meeting with Don Juan and Don Gennaro, and that I needed more than anything else to clear up the uncertainties of that last meeting had created in me. "We're bound to one another," he said. "I'll do anything I can to help you, you know that. But I must warn you that I am not as strong as you would want me to be. Perhaps it would be better if we didn't talk at all. But on the other hand, if we don't talk, then we'll never understand anything." In a careful and deliberate manner, I formulated my query. I explained that there was one single issue at the crux of my rational predicament. "Tell me, Pablito," I said, "did we truly jump with our bodies into the abyss?" "I don't know," he said. "I really don't know." "But you were there with me. That's the point. Was I really there?" I felt annoyed at his cryptic replies. I had the sensation that if I would shake him or squeeze him, something in him would be set free. It was apparent to me that he was deliberately withholding something of great value. I protested that he would choose to be secretive with me when he had a bond of trust with me. Pablito shook his head as if silently objecting to my accusation. I asked him to recount to me his whole experience, starting from the time prior to our jump when Don Juan and Don Gennaro had prepared us together for the final onslaught. Pablito's account was muddled and inconsistent. All he could remember about the last moments before we jumped into the abyss was that after Don Juan and Don Gennaro had said goodbye, the both of us had disappeared into the darkness. His strength waned. He was about to fall on his face, but I held him by his arm and carried him to the edge of the abyss, and there he blacked out. "What happened after you blacked out, Pablito?" "I don't know. Do you have dreams or visions? What did you see?" "As far as I'm concerned, I had no visions. Or if I didn't, I couldn't pay any attention to them. My lack of impeccability makes it impossible for me to remember them." "And then what happened?" "I woke up at Gennaro's place. I don't know how I got there." He remained quiet while I frantically searched my mind for a question, a comment, a critical statement, or anything that would add extra breath to his statements. As it was, nothing in Pablito's account was usable to buttress what had happened to me. I felt cheated. I was almost angry with him. My feelings were a mixture of pity for Pablito and myself, and at the same time, a most intense disappointment. "I'm sorry I'm such a letdown to you," Pablito said. My immediate reaction to his words was to cover up my feelings and assure him I was not disappointed at all. "I am a sorcerer," he said, laughing. "A poor one, but enough of one to know what my body tells me. And right now it tells me that you are angry with me." "I am not angry, Pablito," I explained. "That's what your reason says, but not your body," he said. "Your body is angry. Your reason, however, finds no reason to feel anger towards me. So you're caught in a crossfire. The least I can do for you is to untangle this. Your body is angry because it knows that I am not impeccable, and that only an impeccable warrior can help you. Your body is angry because it feels that I am wasting myself. I knew all that the minute I walked through the door." I don't know what to say. I didn't know what to say. I felt a flood of post-fact realizations. Perhaps he was right in saying that my body knew all that. At any rate, his directness in confronting me with my feelings had blunted the edge of my frustration. I began to wonder if Pablito was not just playing a game with me. I told him that being so direct and bold, he could not possibly be as weak as he had pictured himself to be. "My weakness is that I am made to have longings," he said, almost in a whisper. "I'm even to the point where I long for my life as an ordinary man. Can you believe that?" "You can't be serious, Pablito," I explained. "I am," he replied. "I long for the grand privilege of walking the face of the earth as an ordinary man without this awesome burden." I found his stand simply preposterous and caught myself exclaiming over and over that he could not possibly be serious. Pablito looked at me and sighed. I was overtaken by his sudden apprehension. He seemed to be on the verge of tears. My apprehension gave way to an intense feeling of empathy. Neither of us could help each other. Bogota came back to the kitchen at that moment. Pablito seemed to experience an instantaneous revitalization. He jumped to his feet and stomped on the floor. "What the hell do you want?" he yelled in a shrill, nervous voice. "Why are you snooping around?" Bogota addressed me as if he did not exist. She politely said that she was going to Soledad's house. "What the hell do you care where? What the hell do we care where you go?" he yelled. "You can go to hell for that matter." He stomped on the floor like a spoiled child, while Agorda stood there laughing. "Let's get out of this house, Maestro," he said loudly. His sudden shift from sadness to anger fascinated me. I became engrossed in watching him. One of the features that I had always admired was his nimbleness. Even when he stomped his feet, his movements had grace. He suddenly reached across the table and nearly snatched my writing pad away from me. He grabbed it with the thumb and index finger of his left hand. I had to hold on to it with both hands, using all my strength. There was such an extraordinary force in his pull that had he really wanted to take it, he could have easily jerked it away from my grip. He let go as he retrieved his hand. I saw a fleeting image of an extension to it. It happened so fast that I could have explained it as a visual distortion on my part, a product of the jolt of having to stand up halfway, drawn by the force of his pull. But I had learned by then that I could neither behave with those people in my accustomed manner, nor could I explain anything in my accustomed manner. So I did not even try. "What's in your hand, Pablito?" I asked. He recoiled in surprise and hid his hand behind his back. He had a blank expression and mumbled that he wanted us to leave that house because he was becoming dizzy. Lagoda began to laugh loudly and said that Pablito was a good deceiver, as good a deceiver as Josefina, and maybe even better. But if I pressed him to tell me what was in his hand, he would faint and Nestor would have to tend to him for months. Pablito began to choke. His face became almost purple. Lagoda told him in a nonchalant tone to cut out the acting because he had no audience. She was leaving, and I did not have much patience. She then turned to me and told me in a most commanding tone to stay there and not go to the Gennaro's house. "Why in the hell not?" Pablito yelled and stomped in front of her as if trying to stop her from leaving. "What gall, telling the maestro what to do? We had a bout with the Allies in your house last night," Lagoda said to Pablito matter-of-factly. "And the Nawalan I are still weak from that. If I were you, Pablito, I would put my attention to work. Things have changed. Everything has changed since he came." Bogota left through the front door. I became aware then that indeed she looked very tired. Her shoes seemed too tight, or perhaps she was weak and that her feet dragged a little bit. She seemed small and frail. I thought that I must have looked as tired, since there were no mirrors in the house. I had the urge to go outside and look at myself in the side mirror of my car. I perhaps would have done it, but Pablito thwarted me. He asked me in the most earnest tone not to believe a word of what she had said about his being a deceiver. I told him not to worry about it. "You don't like Lagorda at all, do you?" I asked. "You can say that again," he replied with a fierce look. "You know better than anyone alive the kind of monsters those women are. The Nawal told us that one day you were going to come here just to fall into their trap. He begged us to be on the alert and warn you about their designs. The Nawal said you had one out of four chances. If our power was high, we could bring you here ourselves and warn you and save you. If our power was low, we ourselves would arrive here just in time to see your corpse. The third chance was to find you either the slave of the witch Soledad or the slave of those disgusting mannish women And the fourth chance, the faintest one of all, was to find you alive and well. The Narwhal told us that in case you survived, you would then be the Narwhal and we should trust you, because only you could help us. I'll do anything for you, Pablo, you know that. Not just for me, I'm not alone. The Witness and Benigno are with me. We are together, and you have to help all of us. Of course, Pablo, that goes without saying. People around here have never bothered us. Our problems are only with those ugly, mannish freaks. We don't know what to do with them. The Narwhal gave us orders to stay around them no matter what. He gave me a personal task, but I failed at it. I was very happy before. You remember? Now I can't seem to manage my life anymore. What happened, Pablito? Those witches drove me from my house. They took over and pushed me out like trash. I now live in Gennaro's house with Nestor and Benigno. We even have to cook our own meals. The Narwhal knew that this might happen and gave LaGorda the task of mediating between us and those three bitches. But LaGorda is still what the Narwhal used to call her, the 220 Buttocks. That was her nickname for years and years, because she tipped the scales at 220 pounds. Pablito chuckled at his recollection of LaGorda. She was the fattest, smelliest slob you'd ever want to see, he went on. Today she's half her real size, but she's still the same fat, slow woman up there in her head, and she can't do a thing for us. But you're here now, Maestro, and our worries are over. Now we are four against four. I wanted to interject a comment, but he stopped me. Let me finish what I have to say before that witch comes back to throw me out, he said, as he nervously looked at the door. I know what they have told you, that the five of you are the same because you are the Narwhal's children. That's a lie. You are also like us, the Gennaros, because Gennaro has helped to make your luminosity. You're one of us too. See what I mean? So don't you believe what they tell you. You also belong to us. The witches don't know that the Narwhal told us everything. They think that they are the only ones who know. It took two Toltecs to make us. We are the children of both those witches. Wait, Pablito, I said, putting my hand over his mouth. He stood up, apparently frightened by my sudden movement. What do you mean that it took two Toltecs to make us? The Narwhal told us that we are Toltecs. All of us are Toltecs. He said that a Toltec is a receiver and a holder of mysteries. The Narwhal and Gennaro are Toltecs. They gave us their special luminosity and their mysteries. We received their mysteries, and now we hold them. His usage of the word Toltec baffled me. I was familiar only with it in its anthropological meaning. In that context, it always refers to a culture of the Nahuatl-speaking people in central southern Mexico, which was extinct at the time of the conquest. Why did he call us Toltecs, I asked, not knowing what else to say. Because that's what we are. Instead of saying that we are sorcerers or witches, he said that we are Toltecs. If that's the case, why do you call the little sisters witches? Oh, that's just because I hate them. That has nothing to do with what we are. Did the Narwhal tell that to everyone? Why, certainly, everyone knows. But he never told me that. Oh, that's because you are a very educated man and are always discussing stupid things. He laughed in a forced, high-pitched tone and patted me on the back. Did the Narwhal by any chance tell you that the Toltecs were ancient people that lived in this part of Mexico, I asked. See, there you go. That's why he didn't tell you. The old crow probably didn't know that they were an ancient people. He rocked in his chair as he laughed. His laughter was very pleasing and very contagious. We are Toltecs, Maestro, he said. Rest assured that we are. That's all I know. You can ask the witness. He knows. I lost my interest a long time ago. He stood up and went over to the stove. I followed him. He examined the pot of food cooking on a low fire. He asked me if I knew who had made the food. I was pretty sure LaGorda had made it, but I said that I did not know. He sniffed it four or five times in short inhalations like a dog. Then he announced that his nose told him that LaGorda had cooked it. He asked me if I had had some, and when I said that I had had, that I had finished eating just before he arrived, he took a bowl from the shelf and helped himself to an enormous portion. He recommended in very strong terms that I should eat food cooked only by LaGorda, and I should only use her bowl as he himself was doing. I told him that LaGorda and the Little Sisters had served me my food in a dark bowl that they kept on a shelf apart from the others. He said that that bowl belonged to the Nawal. We went back to the table, we ate very slowly, and did not talk at all. His total absorption in eating made me realize that all of them did the same thing. They ate in complete silence. LaGorda is a great cook, he said, as he finished his food. She used to feed me. That was ages ago, before she hated me, before she became a witch. I mean a Toltec. He looked at me with a glint in his eyes and winked. I felt obligated to compliment that LaGorda did not strike me as being capable of hating anyone. I asked him if he knew that she had lost her form. That's a lot of baloney, he explained. He stared at me as if measuring my look of surprise, and then hid his face under his arm and giggled like an embarrassed child. Well, she actually did do that, he added. She's just great. Why do you dislike her then? I'm going to tell you something, Maestro, because I trust you. I don't dislike her at all. She's the very best. She's the Nawal's woman. I just act that way with her because I like her to pamper me, and she does. She never gets mad at me. I could do anything. Sometimes I get carried away, and I get physical with her and want to strike her. When that happens, she just jumps out of the way like the Nawal used to do. The next minute, she doesn't even remember what I did. That's a true formless warrior for you. She does the same thing with everyone. But the rest of us are a sorry mess. We are truly bad. Those three witches hate us, and we hate them back. You are sorcerers, Pablito. Can't you stop all this bickering? Sure we can, but we don't want to. What do you expect us to do? Be like brothers and sisters? I don't know what to say. They were the Nawal's woman, he went on, and yet everybody expected me to take them. How in heaven's name am I going to do that? I tried with one of them, and instead of helping me, the bastardly witch nearly killed me. So now every one of those women is after my hide as if I had committed a crime. All I did was to follow the Nawal's instructions. He told me that I had to be intimate with each one of them, one by one, until I could hold all of them at once. But I couldn't be intimate with even one of them. I wanted to ask him about his mother, Donna Soledad, but I could not figure out a way to bring her into the conversation. At that point, we were quiet for a moment. Do you hate them for what they've tried to do to you? He asked all of a sudden. I saw my chance. No, not at all, I said. LaGorda explained to me their reasons, but Donna Soledad's attack was very scary. Do you see her very much? He did not answer. He looked at the ceiling. I repeated my question. I noticed then that his eyes were filled with tears. His body shook, convulsed by quiet sobs. He said that once he had had a beautiful mother, whom no doubt I could still remember. Her name was Manuelita, a saintly woman who raised two children, working like a mule to support them. He felt the most profound veneration for that woman who had loved and reared him. But one horrible day his fate was fulfilled, and he had the misfortune to meet Gennaro and the Nawal, and between the two of them, they destroyed his life. In a very emotional tone, Pablito said that the two devils took his soul and his mother's soul. They killed his Manuelita and left behind that horrendous witch, Soledad. He peered at me with his eyes flooded with tears and said that that hideous woman was not his mother. She could not possibly be his, Manuelita. He sobbed uncontrollably. I did not know what to say. His emotional outburst was so genuine and his contemplations so truthful that I felt swayed by a tide of sentiment. Thinking as an average civilized man, I had to agree with him. It certainly looked as if it was a great misfortune for Pablito to have crossed the path of Don Juan and Don Gennaro. I put my arm around his shoulder and almost wept myself. After a long silence, he stood up and went out to the back. I heard him blowing his nose and washing his face in a pail of water. When he returned, he was calmer. He was even smiling. "Don't get me wrong, Maestro," he said. "I don't blame anyone for what has happened to me. It was my fate. Gennaro and the Nawal acted like impeccable warriors they were. I'm just weak, that's all, and I have failed in my task." The Nawal said my only chance to avoid the attack of that horrendous witch was to corral the four winds and make them into my four corners. But I failed. Those women were in cahoots with that witch soul bad and didn't want to help me. They wanted me dead. The Nawal also told me that if I failed, you wouldn't stand a chance yourself. He said that if she killed you, I had to flee and run for my life. He doubted that I could even get as far as the road. He said that with your power and with what the witch already knows, she would have been peerless. So when I felt I had failed to corral the four winds, I considered myself dead. And of course, I hated those women. But today, Maestro, you bring me new hope. I told him that his feelings for his mother had touched me very deeply. I was, in fact, appalled by all that had happened, but I doubted intensely that I had brought hope to him of any kind. "You have," he explained with a great certainty. "I felt terrible all this time. To have your own mother coming after you with an axe is nothing anyone can feel happy about. But now that she's out of the way, thanks to you and whatever you did, those women hate me because they're convinced I'm a coward. They just can't get it through their thick heads that we are different. And you and those four women are different than me and the witness and Benigno in one important way. All five of you were pretty much dead before the Nawal find you. He told us that once you had even tried to kill yourself. We were not that way. We were well and alive and happy. We are the opposite of you. You are desperate people. We are not. If Gennaro hadn't come my way, I would have been a happy carpenter today, or perhaps I would have died. It doesn't matter. I would have done what I could, and that would have been fine. His words plunged me into a curious mood. I had to admit that he was right, and that those women and myself were indeed desperate people. If I had not met Don Juan, I would no doubt be dead. But I could not say, as Pablito had, that it would have been fine with me either way. Don Juan had brought life and vigor to my body and freedom to my spirit. Pablito's statements made me remember something Don Juan had told me once when we were talking about an old man, a friend of mine. Don Juan had said in the very emphatic terms that the old man's life or death had no significance whatsoever. I felt a bit cross at what I thought to be redundance on Don Juan's part. I told him that it went without saying that the life and death of that old man had no significance, since nothing in the world could possibly have any significance except to each one of us personally. "You said it," he exclaimed and laughed. "That's exactly what I mean. That old man's life and death has no significance to him personally. He could have died in 1929 or in 1950, or he could have lived until 1995. It doesn't matter. Everything is stupidly the same to him. My life before I met Don Juan had been that way. Nothing ever mattered to me. I used to act as if certain things affected me, but that was only a calculated ploy to appear a sensitive man. Pablito spoke to me and disrupted my reflection. He wanted to know if he had hurt my feelings. I assured him that it was nothing. In order to start up the conversation again, I asked him where he had met Don Gennaro. My fate was that my boss got ill, he said, and I had to go to the city market in his place to build a new section of clothing booths. I worked there for 2 months. While I was there, I met the daughter of the owner of one of the booths. We fell in love. I built her father's stand a little bigger than the others so I could make love to her under the counter while her sister took care of the customers. One day, Gennaro bought a sack of medicinal plants, brought a sack of medicinal plants to a retailer across the aisle. And while they were talking, he noticed that the clothing stand was shaking. He looked carefully at the stand, but he only saw the sister sitting on a chair, half asleep. The man told Gennaro that every day the stand shook like that around that hour. The next day, Gennaro brought the narwhal to watch the stand shaking, and sure enough, that day it shook. They came back the next day, and it shook again. So they waited there until I came out. That day, I made their acquaintance, and soon after, Gennaro told me that he was an herbalist and proposed to make me a potion that no woman could resist. I liked women, so I fell for it. He certainly made the potion for me, but it took him 10 years. In the meantime, I got to know him very well, and I grew to love him more than if he were my own brother. And now, I miss him like hell. So you see, he tricked me. Sometimes I'm glad that he did. Most of the time, I resent it, though. Don Juan told me that sorcerers have to have an omen before they choose someone. Was there something of that sort with you, Pablito? Yes, Gennaro said that he got curious watching the stand shaking, and then he saw that two people were making love under the counter. So he sat down to wait for the people to come out. He waited to see who they were. After a while, the girl appeared in the stand, but he missed me. He thought it was very strange that he would miss me after being so determined to set his eyes on me. The next day he came back with the narwhal, who also saw the two people were making love. But when it was time to catch me, they both missed me. They came back again the next day. Gennaro went around to the back of the stand while the narwhal stayed out in front. I bumped into Gennaro while I was crawling out. I thought he hadn't seen me because I was still behind the piece of cloth that covered a small square opening I had made on the sidewall. I began to bark to make him think that there was a small dog under the drape. He growled and barked back at me and really made me believe that there was a huge mad dog on the other side. I got so scared that I ran out the other way and crashed into the narwhal. If he would have been an ordinary man, I would have thrown him to the ground because I ran right into him. But instead, he lifted me up like a child. I was absolutely flabbergasted. For being such an old man, he was truly strong. I thought I could use a strong man like that to carry lumber for me. Besides, I didn't want to lose face with the people who had seen me running out from under the counter. I asked him if he would like to work for me. He said yes. The same day, he went to the shop and started to work as my assistant. He worked there every day for 2 months. I didn't have a chance with those two devils. The incongruous image of Don Juan working for Pablito was extremely humorous to me. Pablito began to imitate the way Don Juan carried lumber on his shoulders. I had to agree with LaGuardia that Pablito was as good an actor as Josefina. Why did they go to all that trouble, Pablito? They had to trick me. You don't think that I would go with them just like that, do you? I've heard all my life about sorcerers and curers and witches and spirits, and I never believed a word of it. Those two who talked about things like that were just ignorant people. If Gennaro had told me that he and his friend were sorcerers, I would have walked out on them. But they were too clever for me. Those two foxes were really sly. They were in no hurry. Gennaro said he would have waited for me if it took him 20 years. That's why the Nahuatl went to work on me. I asked him, went to work for me. I asked him to. So it was really me who gave them the key. The Nahuatl was a diligent worker. I was a little bit of a rascal in those days, and I thought I was the one playing a trick on him. I believed that the Nahuatl was just a stupid old Indian, so I told him I was going to tell the boss that he was my grandpa, otherwise they wouldn't hire him. But I had to get a percentage of his salary. The Nahuatl said that that was fine with him, and he gave me something out of the few pesos he made every day. My boss was very impressed with my grandpa because he was such a hard worker. But the other guys made fun of him. As you know, he had a habit of cracking all his joints from time to time. In the shop, he cracked them every time he carried something. People naturally thought that he was so old that when he carried something on his back, his whole body creaked. I was pretty miserable with the Nahuatl as my grandpa. But then Gennaro had already prevailed on my greedy side. He told me that he was feeding the Nahuatl a special formula made out of plants and that it made him strong as a bull. Every day he used to bring a small bundle of mashed up green leaves and feed it to him. Gennaro said that his friend was nothing without his concoction, and to prove it to me, he didn't give it to him for 2 days. Without the green stuff, the Nahuatl seemed to be just a plain, ordinary old man. Gennaro told me that I could also use his concoction to make women love me. I got very interested in it, and he said that we could be partners if I would help him prepare his formula and give it to his friend. One day he showed me some American money and told me he had sold his first batch to an American. That hooked me, and I became his partner. My partner Gennaro and I had great designs. He said that I should have my own shop because with the money that we were going to make with his formula, I could afford anything. I bought a shop and my partner paid for it. So I went wild. I knew that my partner was for real when I began to work making his green stuff. I had the strange conviction at that point that Don Gennaro must have used psychotropic plants in making his concoction. I reasoned that he must have tricked Pablito into ingesting it in order to assure his compliance. "Did he give you power plants, Pablito?" I asked. "Sure," he replied. "He gave me his green stuff. I ate tons of it." He described and imitated how Don Juan would sit by the front door of Gennaro's house in a state of profound lethargy, and then spring to life as soon as his lips touched the concoction. Pablito said, in view of such a transformation, he was forced to try it himself. "What was in the form there?" I asked. "Green leaves," he replied. "Any green leaves he could get a hold of." That was the kind of devil Gennaro was. He used to talk about his formula and make me laugh until I was high as a kite. God, I really loved those old days. I laughed out of nervousness. Pablito shook his head from side to side and cleared his throat 2 or 3 times. He seemed to be struggling not to weep. "As I've already said, Maestro," he went on, "I was driven by greed. I secretly planned to dump my partner once I had learned how to make the green stuff myself. Gennaro must have always known the designs I had in those days. And just before he left, he hugged me and told me that it was time to fulfill my wish. It was time to dump my partner, for I had already learned to make the green stuff." Pablito stood up. His eyes were filled with tears. "That son of a gun, Gennaro," he said softly. "That rotten devil. I truly loved him. And if I weren't the coward I am, I would be making his green stuff today." End of part 1 of the chapter 4, the Gennaro.